Gaza Corner tonight came about when some of you may know that last week I mentioned that my favorite cousin in the world, Alan Wertheim, died suddenly in a tragic accident when he fell and cracked his head. I attended the funeral just a few days ago, and in the Jewish tradition, you sit Shiva, actually for I think 7 days, but after the memorial service, we went back to the house of the family, and friends and family were there to reflect on Alan and to comfort each other. There were about 300 people at the service, and it was also webcast to foreign countries. That's how many friends Alan had. And I would guess maybe 100 people came back to sit Shiva afterwards. I sat next to a handsome older man. He was 80 years old, to my right. We exchanged pleasantries, and after hearing his accent, I asked where he was from. He told me he grew up in Baghdad and emigrated to Israel when he was 13. Israel was only a year old. It was 1949. He told me that he was drafted into the Israeli army in 1953. And he also told me that he changed his name because Muslim names were not allowed. His name was Karim, and he couldn't be a Karim and be in the Israeli Defense Forces. So he changed his name from Karim to Danny. That law, by the way, has since changed. Danny told me he asked to be a paratrooper because he thought the uniforms were really snazzy. So I was thinking, 1953, were there any military conflicts? And Danny said, yes. He told me an Israeli pregnant mother was murdered. Later, I did some research and learned that a mother and her two infant children were murdered in the village of Yehud in 1953. Danny told me, quote, "We learned what village the murderer was from, and we took care of business. We bombarded the village, killed them all." He talked matter-of-factly. I was not familiar with this massacre, but it's easy to look up. I got home, and I just went 1953 Jordanian massacre, and the Qibla massacre came up. All the entries, Qibla, Qibla massacre. I asked Danny if he thought the punishment fit the crime. He put his finger over his mouth and said in a hushed tone, "We agreed long ago. We agreed in our unit. We keep it secret. We keep the massacres secret and do so to this very day. And I don't know you." And with that, he changed the subject. The Qibla massacre, and I'm going to be referencing two articles that are linked at the Tangents website and on the Tangents playlist. One is from what's called Plus 972 blog. 972 is an Israeli area code, and also an article from Counterpunch. At 9:30 at night, on the night of October 14th, 1953, soldiers from Israel's paratroopers unit, as well as Commando Unit 101, fired mortars at the West Bank villages then under Jordanian control of Qibla, and Nilin. Following the barrage, over 130 soldiers swarmed Qibla, laying down landmines on the outskirts of the village in order to prevent Jordanian troops from accessing it. Qibla was almost totally destroyed. The attackers blew up 45 houses, blew up a school, a water pumping station, police station, telephone office. The Israelis sustained zero casualties. Qibla was virtually undefended. Of the first 42 bodies recovered after the massacre, 38 of the 42 were women and children. One man lost all 11 members of his family. Describing the scene, a UN observer stated that, quote, bullet-riddled bodies near the doorways and multiple bullet hits on the doors of the demolished houses indicated that the inhabitants had been forced to remain inside until their homes were blown up over them. In all, 69 people were massacred in a six-hour killing spree, most of them in cold blood by throwing grenades, including those who attempted to flee for their lives. Many were killed under the rubble of their own homes. The soldiers received the following order from then-commander 25-year-old Ariel Sharon, quote, the intention, attack and conquer the village of Kibya with maximum damage to humans and property, unquote. The massacre took place in the wake of the murder, as I mentioned, of a mother and her two infant children in the Israeli town Yehud. Israeli newspapers quoted Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion when reporting that the massacre was committed by, quote, settlers living on the border. Some of them live through Nazi concentration camps, while others are immigrants from Muslim countries where the tradition of revenge is strong and their patience ran out. No one will be more sorry than the Israeli government should it turn out that innocent blood was spilled in the revenge attack. The Israeli government vehemently rejects the outlandish and fantastical versions of the story which claim that the Israeli soldiers took part in the operation against Kibya. We examined the issue and found that not a single military unit was missing from its base on the night of the attack on Kibya. That's what the state fed the media, and the media drank it all up. The newspaper reports from October 1953 are incredible, both in terms of the lies they tell, as well as how similar they are to today's stories. And all of this despite the fact that the editors were well aware of reports from around the world that pointed the finger at the Israeli army. They were also aware of the simple logic that the scope of the killings and damage in the village, along with the coordinated efforts in Nielin, must have been the work of a well-trained military unit. The lies were revealed over time, but not a single person involved in the massacre or its cover-up was ever put on trial. Some of them, like those from Unit 101, turned into cultural assets in Israel, especially, of course, Ariel Sharon, who became prime minister. Sharon was the head of the Israeli Special Forces group called Unit 101, which spearheaded the massacre. And at the time, he feigned ignorance of the massacre. His explanation was that he thought all villagers had fled and that the houses were completely unoccupied as they were being blown up. He also stated that he wasn't aware until the next day that any civilians had died. Most of the Israeli media adopted the lies of Sharon and the state, and this continues, this strategy continues to this very day, allowing crimes to be committed with impunity. As a footnote to the Kibya massacre, Counterpunch reported that, quote, it's a mystery why Kibya was even chosen by the Israelis in the first place, since there was no evidence that the attacker who killed the Israelis came from Kibya. There was an attempt to locate the murderer using bloodhounds, but the trail was lost less than 1 mile over the Jordanian border near a town called Rantis. Although the murderer almost certainly came from Jordan, that can't possibly justify randomly selecting a Jordanian village, destroying it, and killing all its inhabitants, or at least most of the inhabitants. And a second footnote, sadly, the incident Kibya was not Ariel Sharon's only involvement with the mass murder of civilians. Nearly 30 years later, in 1982, between 800 and 3,000 civilians were killed in the southern Lebanon refugee camps of Sabra and Shatila, under the eye of Ariel Sharon. The links to the Counterpunch article, as well as the link to the other article that I referenced, the Plus 972 blog. Those links are at tangents.com. The music I'd like to play for Gaza Corner tonight, we can't get all of it in, but this is the composition and music of Hafez Modirzadeh, the Persian composer and keyboardist living in the Bay Area. This is called The People's Blues. It was conceived in honor of the Kurdish victims of the U.S.-Iraqi war in the Persian Gulf. And it's also dedicated to similar struggles for self-determination. And I dedicate it to the Palestinians who were killed in the Qibya massacre. This is Hafez Modirzadeh.